Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, November the 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Hillary Clinton has an edge, but the email controversy adds uncertainty.
Very inappropriate, I believe, a violation of the Hatch Act for the FBI to acquiesce to that 10 days before an election.
But Donald Trump is seizing on it.
Hillary is the one who broke the law over and over and over again.
We are closing out Breast Cancer Awareness Month with an update on the progress we're making. Also ahead, we've got new movie reviews. It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. Justice Department says it's working with the Federal Bureau of Investigation to conduct the revived investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails as expeditiously as possible. FBI Director James Comey informed Congress on Friday that law enforcement officials will examine a new batch of emails found on a computer during the probe into the estranged husband of a close Clinton aide. But at a campaign rally in Ohio on Monday, Clinton challenged the FBI's inquiry.
And I am sure they will reach the same conclusion they did when they looked at my emails for the last year. There is no case here.
But Donald Trump at a campaign event in Michigan did try to capitalize on the controversy.
Hillary is the one who broke the law over and over and over again. We can be sure that what is in those emails is absolutely devastating. And I think we're going to find out, by the way.
FBI Director Comey has given no information about what investigators found to spark the new probe. I'm joined now by Daniel Lipman, co-author of the daily newsletter Politico Playbook. Daniel, how unusual is this?
Usually 60 days or less for an election. The government really tries very hard not to make any news positive or negative about the candidates that are running. And so the fact that he did not live up to that basically order, the Justice Department raises questions of his judgment as well.
Is that a precedent or is that a sort of a rule or what is that?
It's kind of both. The last several administrations, every time there's an election, the Justice Department, the Attorney General, in this case Loretta Lynch, but in previous administrations, the former Attorney Generals, they issue a rule, kind of an advisory guidance to all their employees saying, try very hard not to basically do anything that would influence voters about which candidates to vote for or against. But the FBI is independent of their overseer, and so Comey doesn't have to do exactly what he's supposed to because he is independent from the Justice Department, and so he is a law enforcement official.
But is it unusual for someone that heads the FBI to sort of go against what the Justice Department recommends?
Yeah, it's definitely unusual. And what happened was he told the Justice Department a little bit before he sent this letter, and he said that he was going to do this, and they cautioned him against it. And so it is very unusual, and former prosecutors were critical of Comey for going against this precedent. To me, that letter, he did not say much about what was in the evidence. And so it kind of cast a cloud over Hillary when it may turn out that she didn't do anything wrong. And so coming 9 days before an election, that was a lot of Democrats are raising red flags about that.
Do you think this could alter and will alter the election? Could it literally change everything?
I think barring an indictment, Hillary is the odds-on favorite to win. So the fact that there's no evidence in these emails that have been released yet, so I don't think it's going to influence the presidential election. And there's been polls that say that most voters are not influenced by news of the new emails, but it definitely could help Republicans keep some of the Senate seats that they were worried that they were going to lose.
So you don't think this could literally turn it around and Donald Trump could win the election?
He's saying that this is worse than Watergate, but both Democrats and some Republicans say that this is just hyperbole and that, you know, his campaign is still expecting an uphill battle to win.
That's Daniel Lipman, co-author of the daily newsletter, Politico Playbook. Thank you for being with us. Well, Democrats and one prominent Republican have accused FBI Director Comey of wielding his authority for political purposes. Richard Painter, who served as the White House chief ethics lawyer under President George W. Bush, has filed complaints with the Office of Special Counsel and the Office on Government Ethics. He joins me now for more. What is your take on this?
The FBI does not routinely and indeed almost never updates members of Congress or others or the public on investigations as they are proceeding. The FBI, at the end of an investigation, decides whether to file criminal charges or not and may make a public statement. But what this committee is asking for is continual updates on an investigation of a political opponent of the Republicans on the committee. That is highly inappropriate, and it becomes, I believe, a violation of the Hatch Act for the FBI to acquiesce to that 10 days before an election. Give them a letter like this with the knowledge that they are going to immediately use that letter for only one purpose, which is to influence the election that's going to happen on November 8th. That's improper, and it's a violation of the Hatch Act.
And for those people that may not really understand or have a deep knowledge about what the Hatch Act is, can you just explain that?
The Hatch Act prohibits executive branch officials from using their official position for the purpose of influencing the outcome of a partisan election. That is not what executive branch officials are permitted to do. Certain officials are exempt from the Hatch Act, but in the executive branch, that's only the president and the vice president. In the legislative branch, the members of Congress are exempt from the Hatch Act. But the people who are exempt from the Hatch Act are not permitted to use others in the government who are subject to the Hatch Act and pressure them to engage in purely partisan acts in their official capacity. And I believe that that is what has happened here through the release of this letter to the committee and then by the committee to the public.
What do you say to Comey, who said he felt like he had an obligation to get it out before it leaked out?
The FBI does not have an obligation to conduct investigations of the political opponent of the majority members of the committee and then give that information to the majority members of the committee for purposes of leaking. We don't use the FBI to investigate political opponents, and that's why, as I pointed out in my op-ed, this is a lot more serious than an ordinary Hatch Act violation. This is using the FBI to try to investigate political opponents and then get the information out in order to influence an election. And that is a highly inappropriate use of the FBI.
And I know you've taken some action.
Well, yes, I did ask the Office of Special Counsel to investigate the Hatch Act violation, and I asked the Office of Government Ethics to work with the Department of Justice to see to it that the government ethics rules that I believe were also violated, that is investigated as well.
So he did not have an obligation to write the letter.
He did not have an obligation to write that letter. This is information that he clearly could have conveyed to the committee on November 9, and the members of the committee had said, you should have told us before the election. It would have been abundantly obvious, as it already is obvious, what they want out of the FBI, which is not a legitimate investigation of the Clinton email, but an investigation for partisan purposes.
Now, just for full disclosure, you're actually a Republican, so this isn't like you're being partisan in your opinion, it would seem.
I am a Republican. I have supported Republican candidates consistently. This time around for president, I supported Jeb Bush. When he dropped out, I caucused here in Minnesota for Marco Rubio. And then when he dropped out, I supported John Kasich. So now I'm down to my fourth choice, and my choice is Hillary Clinton. I do believe that Donald Trump is not fit to be president of the United States, and I think could be quite dangerous as president.
That's Richard Painter, former White House chief ethics lawyer under President George W. Bush. Thank you for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Getting it over with, Americans are voting early this year. Central Italy assesses damage after Sunday's quake. South Sudan ranks among the most deadly for journalists. And singer Adele says she battled depression before and after her son's birth. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Now to the battle to retake Mosul. Iraqi commanders say coalition forces seeking to recapture the northern city have broken through jihadist defense lines east of the city and are poised to enter the Islamic State stronghold. I'm joined now by Jamil Jaffer, professor and director of Homeland and National Security Law at George Mason University School of Law. Jamil, what are you hearing?
The challenge is that even though you've got a larger numeric number on the outside, the Iraqi side, holding the city is going to be a lot stronger position to be in, and they'll be fighting door to door, urban warfare. It's going to be tough. It's going to be bloody. It's going to be challenged with civilians. You hear stories about ISIS using human shields. That's going to be a real challenge for the Iraqi and Kurdish forces as they go into Mosul.
Do we actually have U.S. forces on the ground?
So we have U.S. forces on the ground, but not actually fighting in the fight. We're providing air support. It sounds like we're providing intelligence assistance, and it sounds like we're also mm-hmm. providing some artillery firepower, it looks like.
But we are making progress.
The Iraqi forces and the Kurdish forces are making progress. It's unclear how long the fight to retake Mosul will take. I don't think it'll be quick, again, because of the nature of the urban combat situation they're going to be in. And ISIS is going to make it tough. They've already been lighting, oil on fire to create these sort of noxious fumes in the area, and they're going to make it tough. And remember, ISIS was born out of the fight defending cities. When we remember the campaigns in Fallujah and the like during the Iraq War, towards the end of the Iraq War, and then the insurgency took place. And just because the Iraqi army retakes Mosul, it won't end the threat posed by ISIS in that city alone. They will continue to fight an insurgent war, which was very effective against U.S. troops, back when we were in Iraq, directly in combat. And so you don't want to minimize the challenge of not just taking Mosul, but then holding it and dealing with the fact of insurgency as you go forward.
Right. And where do they go if we push them out of Mosul?
Well, right. That's a great point. So one of the things that's interesting is going on is that the new involvement over the weekend that we've heard about the Iraqi Shia militias. These are government Shia forces sponsored largely by Iran, but Iraqi government approved. They're sort of irregular forces called the Popular Mobilization Forces. They're going to be coming in from the west and try and sort of seal off the ability of the ISIS forces to escape into Syria and also get resupplied. Now, the challenge there is that Mosul has a large Sunni population. The Shia forces being involved might present a challenge. In fact, we've seen the town they're trying to capture, Tal Afar, is a Turkmen town. We've heard the Turkish government say, look, if these Shia Muslims come in, they better do the right thing. If we see any problems with the Turkmen people there, we're gonna deal with that very swiftly. And so, there are some challenges here. And so, the ISIS forces are going to be looking to make a move somewhere, and the question is where are they going to go and what's going to happen there, too.
And then, of course, there are all these civilians that are literally in the crossfire.
So it's a great point, Laura. We've had millions of people displaced by this war. Within Syria alone, internally displaced alone, we've seen over 6 million people, the UN's reported. In just this campaign alone, in Mosul alone, we've seen 20,000 new refugees. Now, that may sound like a small number, relatively speaking, to the millions of the larger conflict, but it's still significant. And as these forces go into Mosul, there will not just be civilian refugees, but there will be civilian casualties. This type of urban warfare will be challenging. And particularly, we've now heard that ISIS plans to use civilians as human shields. In fact, we've recently heard some very troubling reports of a large number of civilians being sort of herded to the center of the city. Now, we don't know whether those reports are true. We don't know what that means. But it could be a scenario where ISIS is looking to put these people in place as human shields to help protect their core. And that's a very troubling scenario if that's in fact what's going on.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. George Mason University School of Law Professor Jamil Jaffer, thanks for being with us. Well, wrapping up Breast Cancer Awareness Month, we are joined by Dr. Sarah Bruce, breast surgeon with Inova Hospital Breast Care Institute in Virginia. It seems like we're hearing about more and more cases of breast cancer, or is it just that we're catching it more often?
Overall, I don't think we're really finding necessarily that many more cases. Some we're finding earlier because of screening. We've got 3D mammograms now that catch things maybe a little bit earlier. What we don't know is whether catching something earlier necessarily translates into improved survival, because we've really come a long way over the last, I'd say, 3 years or so. Survival rates are improving. Death rates from breast cancer have gone down. We've done a lot through the treatments that we have to really improve outcomes. 1 in 8 women, 12% lifetime risk.
And of those women, how many of them have a chance of being cured?
We really have excellent outcomes if we catch the cancers early. So getting your mammogram in order to try and give yourself the best chance at finding something early.
I interviewed somebody about a week ago, and she said a big problem is that there's too much treatment for people who are in early stage that would likely not ever progress.
You know, there's always been controversy, I think, over early non-invasive cancer, ductal carcinoma in situ. It's very early, it's not invasive yet, and maybe it would never turn into an invasive cancer over a woman's lifetime. Problem is, at this point, we don't know how to predict whose early breast cancer, that non-invasive cancer, whose is going to turn into an invasive cancer and whose is not. And we know that some of them will progress. And so, yes, we probably do over-treat some women, but until we know how to predict whose early cancer is, you know, worse than someone else's, then we end up treating all those women because we want to try and prevent the invasive cancers in the future. In my mind, for patients who have those diagnoses of those early non-invasive cancers, it's more important that the patient understands why we're treating it the way we are than what exactly you call it. And we treat it the way we do in order to prevent invasive cancers down the road. And so that often means surgery and sometimes radiation and medication, because all of those treatments help to decrease the chance that a woman develops an invasive cancer in the future.
What does the future look like? Are there new treatments on the horizon that you're aware of?
I think the way I frame it is maybe in two parts. I think that there are treatments that we're really trying to improve upon where there's less morbidity for the patient. So in surgery or radiation, trying to maybe do less surgery, do less radiation, but have the same good outcome. So improving the morbidity for patients. The other piece that, you know, is really a direction we're headed towards is treatments being more targeted. So especially in medications, having a target on the cell, something that a medication can attack directly. So very biologically driven medications, that I think is really, you know, the exciting movement for the future, being able to have medications that specifically attack the tumors and don't necessarily harm other cells in the body.
Well, we appreciate your expertise. Thank you so much. Inova Hospital breast surgeon Dr. Sarah Bruce. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Tuesday, November 8th, the American people choose a new president. VOA's live election night coverage begins at 2200 hours Universal Time. As events unfold, we'll bring you the finale of this historic campaign from Washington and VOA correspondents across the United States and around the world. Tuesday night and Wednesday morning, you'll hear comprehensive coverage until the last speech is done. It's America Votes 2016 on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. Let's turn now to what is happening in U.S. movie theaters with Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, we've got Tom Hanks out with a new film.
Yes, Tom Hanks is back as Professor Robert Langdon from the Dan Brown series, the best-selling series of, I like to call them the Robert Langdon mysteries. And, you know, he started with the very, very popular Da Vinci Code, and then, of course, my favorite, Angels and Demons. And this time we're using Dante's Divine Comedy for clues. There's a madman played by Ben Foster, a billionaire madman. Here's the question, Laura, that the movie asks you, is that if you could push a button and kill half the population of the world in order to save mankind, not because you're some, you know, crazy, you know, supervillain, but just that if you knew you had to kill half the population in order for it to survive, would you do it? And that's the premise of the movie, because it's overpopulation. You know, we're keep tripling and doubling our population more than in the last couple hundred years than we've done in the last 100,000 years. You know, so natural resources are running out. You know, space is running out. Global warming, climate change, you know, people can't live in most of the places where they're being pushed inward. So Ben Foster's character, he's this billionaire named Zorbis, is going to release this deadly virus that's going to kill half the population of the world. So Robert Langdon is a scapegoat for this. He's the catalyst. He's going to be the carrier, and there's a race to stop this deadly virus. So we, just like the last two movies, we're racing all around Europe, mostly in Italy, in Florence, Italy, and also around Istanbul and Turkey. And he has a doctor who helps him, played by Felicity Jones. And also we have a hitman that's after them, played by Irfan Khan. And this is from director Ron Howard. what's funny is that as we rush around trying to find these clues, it seems really kind of contrived, you know. So every time we come across something, he starts, you know, giving us a history lesson. It's almost like we're on tour with him, with Tom Hanks. So we go all around Italy, and he gives all these kind of corny things about different landmarks and different paintings. It's almost like watching the Hardy Boys because it moves so fast. But you know what? It's not clever enough. There's not enough action enough. It's very contrived. And I just think, you know, this one doesn't deliver the thrills and chills that the previous two did.
Well, you know, Halloween, a big deal.
and it's huge.
And for
it's
folks huge. That may not want to go out trick-or-treating, there yeah. are they can always go to the movies.
They can go to the movies. You know, there's a great documentary out right now. And when you say go to the movies, it doesn't mean you have to go to the theater. They have things that are on demand now. One of them that's on demand that I think is a fascinating documentary is from Morgan Spurlock. And he's the director who did Super Size Me. And he has a new documentary about the history of rats. And yes, if you're like me, rats, how these creepy critters, he looks at them all over the world, like how many, there's like maybe 4 or 5 rats per person in New York City. He shows where, how they carry infestations and disease, shows their big business in Cambodia, how there's an ancient temple in India for rats. You have all these exterminators who have been doing this for 30 years. You have people from around the world talking about rats and how they're just this super species and about how they're not going anywhere. And it's a really creepy documentary.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that, Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Well, millions of music fans had their very first listen to Prince 34 years ago this week with the release of his 1999 album. And today, 6 months have already passed since his death. And there still remains a lot of news about Prince. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald and International Edition host Jim Stevenson delve into the latest.
First of all, the investigation into Prince's death will remain sealed until next year, so we're really not going to learn any more specifics. He passed away from an overdose of the drug fentanyl, and police continue to investigate the circumstances surrounding that death. On October 21st, a Minnesota judge extended authorities' search warrant until commencement of criminal proceedings. So that something is still in the works there.
The investigation into his death is quite different from what we saw in Michael Jackson's case, where we knew who the doctor was right away, and there were all sorts of allegations and media reports swirling about him almost immediately.
Well, there were some initial allegations aimed at Prince's physicians, but those seem to have gone away or are simply not being reported on right now. It's very much still under investigation, and they're keeping a tight lid on things. The judge also sealed all documents accompanying that investigation. Now, the website The Wrap says that those documents will remain sealed until next April, which would be the one-year anniversary of Prince's passing.
No!
In other developments, his attorney, L. Londell McMillan, is denying reports that Jay-Z offered $40 million to buy the rights to Prince's unreleased music. He says those music rights are not up for sale, and those responsible are not in discussions with anyone. I don't know if I believe that.
Quite in a massive state sitting there in Minnesota, in both terms of money and also the wealth of music. Apparently, he was just recording constantly.
He was recording constantly. And also, as far as his estate, his physical estate goes, his compound, Paisley Park, there was talk of turning it into a museum. Now, it's in a semi-rural area. It's not very well served by roads. And the county commissioners are a little reluctant to go ahead with that because they worry about Graceland-style crowds. He has so much unreleased music there. And Billboard recently reported that the three U.S. major labels, Sony, Universal, and Warner, are definitely in talks for the rights. They would love to get their hands on this music. And finally, there's the matter of Prince's estate. People claiming to be relatives of Prince continue to emerge from the woodwork. This Wednesday, a judge ruled that two women claiming to be his niece and grandniece are not heirs, so they will not get anything. Prince died without a will, and this complicates things to an incredible degree. A lot of things going on with Prince still.
A lot of news about the purple one and a man who sometimes wears purple while he does his top 20 countdown, Ray McDonald. You can also catch him on Twitter
at Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
That's going to do it for today's show. Thank you so much for joining us. But you can always find us online at voanews.com. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Susan Markham, Senior Coordinator for Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment for the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, wrapped up a five-day visit to Lao PDR in October, during which she met Lao education officials and visited schools to pave the way for the expansion of the U.S. government's Let Girls Learn initiative to Laos, which President Barack Obama announced during his visit to the country in September. Following a meeting with the Minister of Education and Sports, Senjuan Lachantabun, and senior education officials in Vientiane on October 4th, Ms. Markham and her delegation traveled to Luang Prabang and Udomche provinces, where she discussed education and learning needs with teachers, administrators, students, and parents. We are thrilled to have this opportunity to engage with Lao officials, teachers, parents, and students to learn more about education in this beautiful country, Ms. Markham said. Through the Let Girls Learn initiative, we can find new ways to collaborate and help ensure that adolescent girls and boys get the education they need to be successful. On October 7th, Ms. Markham met representatives of the Lao Women's Union, Lao National Commission for Mothers and Children, the Lao National Commission for the Advancement of Women's Secretariat, and other donors and civil society groups focused on women and development to further understand the needs of girls and women across Laos. The U.S. government's Let Girls Learn initiative, championed by First Lady Michelle Obama, works to address the range of challenges preventing adolescent girls from attaining a quality education. Let Girls Learn harnesses existing programs and invests in new efforts to improve educational opportunities for girls worldwide. The United States is proud to work with Laos to help Lao girls develop their full potential for their benefit and for the benefit of their communities and the people of Laos.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.